It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest has tested out two of the latest self-help books on memory improvement. He'll join us to talk about what was helpful, what was not, and whether they're worth a read.
First, Governor Walker has called for giving papermaker Kimberly Clark tax incentives like those offered to Foxconn.
It's part of an effort to entice the Kimberly Clark Corporation not to close a pair of factories in the Neenah area that would result in the loss of almost 600 jobs.
Steve Deller is professor of agriculture and applied economics and the interim director for the Center for Community and Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, Steve, what are you seeing in the governor's proposal to try to keep Kimberly Clark jobs where they are?
Well, I think this is part of the slippery slope that was created with the Foxconn deal. We have set a precedence where other firms can now come in and kind of say, well, where's my tax incentive? But I think with the Kimberly Clark, they're making decisions at an international scale. And, the specific location in Wisconsin is almost secondary to these national and international decisions that they're making.
Right. Kimberly Clark initially announced thousands of jobs being lost, being ended in their worldwide operation. This Wisconsin element is just part of that. Are the tax incentives we're talking about, do you think, enough to have Kimberly Clark change their global plans, in effect?
No, probably not. It's the same type of decision that Kraft made when they were looking at the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison or GM looking at the Janesville plant. These are multi-billion dollar long-term decisions that these companies are making, and these kind of tax incentives are really kind of not that important to these larger decisions.
Now, Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson has said the industry as a whole is suffering. The issue goes beyond Kimberly Clark. Here he is on the morning show earlier today talking about Governor Walker's proposal.
Well, I think what the correct approach here, because this is not a one-off, this began before Kimberly Clark. It started with Appleton Coda back in September. The only solution and strategy is an industry-wide strategy. If this was just one company like Kimberly Clark, maybe that would make sense, though. But we need to have a strategy. We need to have a solution that addresses not just one paper mill, but all the mills that have been affected, and then also to have a strategy that will address this potential problem in the future.
And Nelson said the governor and legislators should push for a $60 million fund to help the papermaking industry, in effect, modernize, be more energy efficient in Wisconsin. What do you think of that idea, Steve?
Well, I think that looking at the industry from a larger perspective is important because the paper industry has been going through major restructuring. And a lot of the new investments in paper mills within the U.S. have been occurring in the southern states because of the supply of pine, faster-growing pine. It's just the comparative advantage that Wisconsin had many decades ago simply it's not here anymore. We have a rich tradition, but the economics that gave us that rich tradition have really shifted. It's shifted to the southern states, and it's shifted overseas.
And let's talk about that overseas component. Senator Tammy Baldwin has said, hey, the federal government needs to do more to balance the playing field. She sees unfair practices, deals, basically helping, say, a Chinese paper manufacturing company at the expense of a Wisconsin one.
Well, it depends on how you define unfair competition. The Chinese and a lot of the Asian companies, countries, have actually embraced not this kind of pure capitalism that the U.S. has, but they really kind of pick particular industries, and they really, as a government, try to help those industries along. Now, is that unfair competition, or is that just a different way of pursuing capitalism? We can come up with different answers to that question.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison and UW Extension, looking at the latest on Kimberly Clark, possible or announced job closures, job layoffs there, and efforts by the state government to try to turn that around. Also from Senator Baldwin, Steve, she wrote an open letter to Kimberly Clark saying, hey, you're getting advantages, you're getting benefits from this new federal tax bill. You're using that to pay dividends, buy back stocks, and at the same time, you're cutting jobs. She was critical of that. What do you make of that line of attack on the company?
Well, I think, I mean, politically, they have to do something. I mean, Governor Walker and, you know, our elected officials are, they have to do something. Otherwise, they'll be perceived as sitting on their hands, which, you know, Mayor Soglin here accused the governor of doing with Oscar Mayer. And it's, so they have to do something. But in terms of how this is actually going to play out, it's really not going to have that much of an influence.
Are we talking about plants, whether it's Oscar or Mayer, as you mentioned earlier, or a lot of the paper mills, that even if they keep them around now, it might be another year or two, but the industry, the wider industry changes are dictating that they're not going to be here forever?
That's exactly right. A lot of the old legacy industries are, they're moving. And look at what happened with the GM plant. It was essentially, you know, the major corporations are saying, you know, look, we're making long-term investments here. Either we can continue to pour money into these older facilities, or we can start new. We can build brand new and build highly efficient plants. What they're doing is they're building new, more efficient plants. And when they make that decision, they're saying, where is the best location for this? And in the paper industry right now, it's in the southern states. It's not in the old North Forest.
Now, supposing these jobs can't be saved, what do you see as the role of the state and maybe local governments in working with those 600 or so workers who are going to be out of a job if this goes through?
Well, there's two. There's a short-term strategy, which is helping these families essentially kind of get over the period of unemployment, is helping them kind of adapt and, you know, kind of get over this initial hump of losing, you know, fairly well-paying jobs. Then there's the long-term strategy of, you know, how do we create a better environment for these employee or these now unemployed folks to find other employment opportunities or to, you know, perhaps start their own businesses. So there's a short-term strategy and a longer-term strategy.
Now, obviously, this is not going to be good news for people laid off. But on the upside, unemployment is low in Wisconsin, especially as compared to the immediate aftermath of the Great Recession. Are you optimistic that a lot of these workers will be able to find work, maybe comparable work?
Yes, they will. There's been examples of other paper mills that have closed down, and workers have been able to find other employment opportunities. But what they're doing is, it's what we call stretch commuting, is that they're commuting greater distances to take these jobs. Now, will they be comparable in terms of pay and benefits? That's a tougher question. I think that's one of the frustrations that we've had with this recovery, is as these good-paying jobs go away, they're being replaced with slightly lower-paying jobs. So I think that these workers will be able to find other employment. They may have to commute a greater distance than perhaps they would like, and perhaps they may not be as good a job, but they'll find employment opportunities.
I know from talking to you in the past, Steve, you're more of a fan of the state if it's going to help somebody, helping startups, newer businesses, smaller businesses to grow. That said,
yep.
Could the state be playing a proactive role, doing an inventory of these bigger legacy businesses and saying, where are we at risk of losing businesses? How do we start working with these companies to keep them around and maybe modernize here in the state?
I think that's an excellent idea. I think the state should be doing this on a continuing basis. But the problem, though, is that when you do an analysis, and we've looked at the paper industry in the past because there's been other plants closing, is that it is a declining industry in the state. And if the state comes out and says, we've done an analysis of this, and it's a declining industry, and we've essentially decided that we're going to let it go away, that's politically untenable. So the state becomes a rock, you know, gets between a rock and a hard place. All the data and the trends in the industry are saying it's going away, but the state just simply can't accept that. So, yes, they should be doing it, but how they react to what we find is another matter.
So we've got proposals from the governor, from Republicans in the legislature, from Democrats in the legislature. Is this all mostly just symbolic?
It is to a large extent. Again, these are international trends that are going on, and some of these plants, like with the GM plant and the Oscar Mayer plant, they're just old, they're not efficient, and it makes more sense to basically say, we're going to build brand new. And that means we could build brand new any place in the U.S.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Stephen Deller is a professor of agriculture and applied economics and interim director for the Center for Community and Economic Development at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. He joined us to check in on the economic effects of a proposed tax incentive for Kimberly-Clark.
Coming up, are you struggling to remember how you met all 700 of your Facebook friends? Can't remember the names of a few new faces at the holiday gathering? Well, a writer tells us about his test drive of some of the latest advice on making the most of our memories. Stay with us here on Central Time.
In a world where we use Google Maps to tell us how to get places, check Facebook to remember people's birthdays, and instruct our iPhones to remind us to breathe, the use of our own memory isn't what it used to be.
Our next guest has been trying some of the latest books that aim to help us boost our memory. Henry Alford is a humorist, author, and journalist. His piece in the New York Times is titled Total Recall, A Reader's Guide to Memory Gain. Henry, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Henry, what got you interested in taking a closer look at the topic of memory, particularly with some of the books that are coming out right now?
Well, for me, it really started when I realized that I take pictures on vacation primarily so that I can remember where I was and when. So it's not about being sentimental. It's not about having a lovely picture of a waterfall. It's simply so that I can remember last October 2017, I visited my mother in Durham, North Carolina.
And should I ask how that visit went, if we're talking about memory right now?
I actually do remember that
visit. Okay, good.
And it went well. But no, it struck me that we're outsourcing so much of our memory to algorithms or to Google and other search functions, or, various devices that, of course, it's gonna have some effect on our powers of recall.
And so, you know, you just said that you have been taking pictures of vacation so you can remember. And, I mean, you're not alone in this. A lot of people do that. Widespread, how big of an issue do you think that this eventually could be?
Well, I'm not a scientist, so I don't have numbers for you, but you've got to imagine that, you know, with the aging baby boomers, that we're really gonna crash into this problem in the next 10 or 15 years in a big way. So I think this is probably a really good time to start thinking about it.
And so the purpose of the article that you wrote in the New York Times was to take a look at some both self-help books, but you also mentioned some fiction books that came out that deal with memory. What are some of the titles that caught your eye?
Well, on the fiction end, two that were really interesting to me were Goodbye Vitamin, which is about a woman who moves back home to because her father has dementia and has started leaving his pants in trees. And then there was a very funny but outrageous kind of sex comedy called Made for Love about a woman whose tech pioneer husband has implanted a chip in her brain that allows him to download all of her experiences.
So, I mean, both of those sound really interesting in the ways that they use memory. Both you have a story about someone from the outside dealing with dementia and then someone whose literal memories are basically able to be downloaded. Do you see, I'm asking a writer question right now, but do you see memory as being a trope that we might be seeing a little bit more of in fiction?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it was really surprising to me that, you know, I started Googling when I had this idea for the article, and I very quickly found about 15 or 20 books that had come out in the past 6 months that were on this topic. In last July alone, there were, I believe, 14 books about the topic of non-historical memory that were published.
So clearly there is an audience for this. And looking at some of the memoirs, I know that one of those was Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia by Gerda Saunders. Can you tell us a little bit about, I guess, what you learned from reading that?
Well, that one, the line that was so chilling to me, it's a woman who obviously is has dementia, and she, one of the lines she writes is, "I am dementing, I am dementing, I am dementing," which it just, there's something about the actual, you know, verb dementing that it just grabbed me and really shook me up. So yeah, so that's my strongest memory of that. The bulk of this piece that I wrote was that I took two of the books, which were nonfiction books, both written by doctors, and followed some of their advice over the course of a month in an effort to improve my own powers of recall.
Yeah, and I want to get to that. I want to remind everyone that we are talking to Henry Elford right now. He's a humorist, author, and journalist for publications such as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Vanity Fair. And he recently had a publication called Total Recall, A Reader's Guide to Memory Gain. And you were just mentioning these kind of self-help books of, you know, helping people or giving recommendations to people on how to improve their memory. So let's really quickly talk about what led you to these two books in particular. Let's just put it out there. Were you worried about your memory going into this?
A little bit, yeah. I started to, some of the proper nouns are starting to go. I'm a little bit of a film geek, and so I love to, and I used to work in the casting industry. So I used to have very good memory of the names of you know, character actors, and that was starting to go. So that's another reason why I wanted to do this.
And so let's first talk about memory rescue, supercharge your brain, reverse memory loss, and remember what matters most by Daniel Amen, or Amen, I'm guessing one of the two. What was your initial impression of that book?
Well, there's a weird thing about these kind of books, which is that because both of the two that I read are essentially workbooks, because they are kind of self-help books that really want you to be following a regimen, and it was interesting with the Amen book that he repeats information, like he encourages you to eat turmeric, and he mentioned turmeric, I'm going to say 28 times in the course of the book. He encouraged you to eat more turmeric in your diet, and I started to feel like, Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby or something. It was like, what is going on? Why is every time I turn the page, he's mentioning turmeric again? So that's a weird, ironic part of these kind of books is, yeah, they are very repetitive because they imagine that most readers are just going to dip in to the chapters that they find interesting.
So maybe that repetition is just to really drive home the points that they think are what's going to make this, I guess, worthwhile for the reader, it sounds like.
I guess, yes.
Turmeric aside, were there any, and let's actually go to the other book that you took a test drive in, which was Seven Steps to Managing Your Memory, What's Normal, What's Not, What to Do About It by Andrew Budson and Maureen O'Connor. I guess impression of this book and how different was it from Amen's book?
Well, they were pretty similar in their suggestions, and essentially the big thing here, what neuroscientists really want us to be doing in order to improve our powers of recall and to ward off dementia, is to be learning new things while being social. So probably that means getting out of the house, although not necessarily, as you know, if you've got other people to do it with. But yeah, that you're learning a skill or a language or a new activity, or you're putting yourself in some kind of new situation and there are other people that are around you. That was kind of the real biggie. The sort of wackier things were, both of the books suggested that you spend 15 minutes a day either in prayer or meditation. that apparently the, you know, just the practice of quieting the mind, it somehow it activates your prefrontal cortex, and that's really good for helping memory. And then I can't remember which of one of the two books had an exercise where you use your non-dominant hand to do household activities. And I think, like learning new while learning something new while being social, this is, it's almost like you're tricking your brain. It's, you know, because we develop patterns and the neural pathways get very worn and grooved, and you wanna shake it up. So using your left hand if you're right-handed is a great thing.
And about the minute that we have left, one of the things that it seemed as though you took away from this experience was maybe the benefits of meditating. What was your experience trying this for, maybe not the first time, but trying it in this experiment?
Well, I fell asleep a couple of times. I just absolutely wasn't able to do, I just couldn't stop, you know, the internal monologue a bunch of times. And then finally, it did work a few times, and I did it for a month, so two of the 30 times, I actually had the best work days of my year. So if you can stick with it, it really pans out.
So if you had to grade this experience, what would you give it?
Oh, I would give it a B+. Yeah, I think definitely, because the meditation thing was really amazing to know. And and both of the books want you to eat unsweetened chocolate.
Oh, so we get a little bit of a fun takeaway on top of the meditation. Well, Henry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
Henry Elford is a humorist, author, and journalist for publications such as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Vanity Fair. He joined us today to talk about the latest books about memory loss and boosting memory from his piece Total Recall, A Reader's Guide to Memory Gain.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Millions of individuals are currently facing anxiety and depression in the United States, and many will treat their disorders with an antidepressant to fix what we're told is a chemical imbalance in the brain. But does that really tell and solve the whole story of depression?
Our next guest has struggled with depression throughout his life and frequently found himself unable to shake it even after increased doses of antidepressants. That eventually sent him looking for answers, and what he found runs contrary to what we've been told about the disorder.
He challenges the idea that depression is caused by a spontaneous chemical reaction in our brains. He says rather it's caused by a handful of key factors in the way we live today. Things like being disconnected from meaningful work, other people, and even the natural world.
Johan Hari joins us now. He's a writer, journalist, and author, and his new book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Johan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, hey, JC. Hi, Rob. I'm really happy to be with you both.
So, Johan, early on in the book, you write that we have been kind of systematically told or given this idea about what depression and anxiety, and I want to include anxiety, what those are. This is a conclusion that you came to after years of research, and you've done hundreds of interviews after going on your own path. From what you can tell, where do you think we maybe got the story wrong?
You know, this is such an important question. This was a kind of mystery that was obsessing me, which was why did depression and anxiety seem to be rising? When I was a teenager, I'd gone to my doctor and I'd explained that I had this feeling like pain was kind of leaking out of me. I couldn't control it. I felt very ashamed of it. And my doctor told me an entirely biological story about why I felt this way. He said, you've just got a chemical imbalance in your brain. The only thing you need to do is take these drugs. And I took the maximum possible dose for 13 years. And, you know, I initially felt a lot of relief, like a lot of people who take them. But that effect really kind of wore off, and I was in really deep distress. So as you say, I ended up going on this big, long journey. I interviewed the leading experts in the world on what really causes depression and anxiety and what really solves them. And one of the things that really shocked me was discovering there are real biological factors that make you more sensitive to these problems. But actually, until I was a teenager and I went to my doctor, I thought depression and anxiety were all in my head, meaning, you know, they were just, I was just being weak. And then for the next 13 years, I thought it was all in my head, meaning, you know, it was a chemical imbalance in my brain. But actually what I discovered is largely, not entirely, but largely, the causes of depression and anxiety are not in our heads. They're in the way we're living today. I learned from the world's leading experts and from the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, that there are 9 causes of depression and anxiety, 7 of which are kind of playing out all around us and 2 are biological. And it's a really important question to ask, well, how did we end up with this very different conception of it? And, you know, everyone listening to this show knows that they have natural physical needs, right? You need food, you need water, you need warmth, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. What these scientists taught me is that we have natural psychological needs too. You've got to feel you belong. You've got to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You've got to feel that people see you and value you. You've got to feel that you've got a future that makes sense. And our culture is good at lots of things, but we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying needs that people have. And I think that's the key reason, it's not the only one, but it's the key reason why there's been such a big rise in all sorts of forms of despair, whether it's been depression, anxiety, or addiction.
And so there is actually a lot there to dig into about these potential all sorts of factors. Let's look at a little bit of the history of where we are right now. How did this, I guess, dominant narrative of chemical imbalance, it being just in your head physically, where did that come from?
Yeah, one of the things that really shocked me was when I went and spoke to experts and read their work in great detail was to discover what a recent invention that idea is. So Professor Andrew Scull at Princeton University says the idea that depression is caused by low serotonin is, as he put it, deeply misleading and unscientific. Dr. David Healy, who's one of the leading experts in Britain, said to me, you can't even say that story has been discredited because it was never credited. There was never a time when half of the people in the field would have said that depression was just caused by low serotonin. Actually, the UN, the leading doctor for the United Nations, explained last year for World Health Day, we need to talk less about chemical imbalances, more about power imbalances. And that was really shocking to me, because when you've got a story about your pain and your distress, even if that story doesn't work very well, you know, it kind of structures how you think about the world, right? It's like putting a leash on a wild animal. At least you know where it is, right? And losing that story was very painful to me. But the reason I made myself continue on this journey is because when we understand what's really causing depression and anxiety, I discovered it opens up very different ways of responding to them. Now, those should be added to the menu of options. We don't want to take anything off the menu. Chemical antidepressants do give some real relief to people. They gave some real relief to me for a while. They give some relief to some of the people I most love. It's not about attacking chemical antidepressants. But for most people, they're not dealing with the core of the problem. They're giving some relief, which is valuable, but they're not dealing with the core of the problem. As you can see from the fact that the last 30 years, every year, prescriptions of antidepressants have risen, and every year depression and anxiety have also risen. They're clearly not solving the underlying problem. So I began to look at what are these deep underlying causes. I'll give you one example and then one solution, if I may. So it's very shocking to me to look at the research on loneliness. We in the United States are the loneliest people there have ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you can call on in a crisis? And when they started doing this research years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. Human beings evolved to live in tribal groups, right? That's the only reason why you and I are alive, because our ancestors were really good at banding together. Professor John Cacioppo at the University of Chicago, who I interviewed a lot, has shown this loneliness, this social isolation, is causing depression and anxiety. And I began to think, well, what's the antidepressant for that, right? And one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is a doctor called Sam Everington, who's based in East London in England. And Sam was very uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him who were depressed and anxious. And he'd been told in his medical training, even though he knew the science didn't say this, to just tell them, oh, you've just got a chemical imbalance in your brain, and offer nothing but drugs. Like me, Sam's not opposed to drugs, but he just thought, this isn't enough, right? One of the things he noticed is how profoundly lonely his patients were. So he decided to do an experiment. A lot of patients came to him. I'll give you an example. One of them was a woman called Lisa Cunningham. She'd been shut away in her home for 7 years with profound depression and anxiety. Sam said to her, I'll carry on giving you drugs, don't worry, but I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe you to take part in a group. There was an area behind the doctor's surgery that was a kind of scrubland, basically. And he said, what I'd like you to do, we'll turn out and support you, but I'd like you to turn up with a group twice a week of other depressed and anxious people, and we're going to turn this into something beautiful. We're going to make it into a garden. Lisa was literally physically sick at the first meeting, right? Super awkward. But what happened is as the weeks began to go by, they began to interact with the natural world. They get their fingers in the soil. There's incredible evidence that interacting with the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But they also began to get to know each other. They started to solve each other's problems, because that's what we do when we begin to form groups and communities. As Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. And really interesting research in Norway of a very similar program found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants.
Sure. So it's it does sound like, based on a lot of the work that you have been able to do, that there's at least, if not anecdotal, but definitely medical evidence that said maybe this is a treatment that could work for a lot of people, and that making sure that social connections are honored day to day, and maybe that might, if not cure, will at least assist in helping people feel a little bit better. We're talking to Johan Hari right now. He's a journalist. He recently wrote a book called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. And he's with us now to talk about that book.
Yeah, and I think that what you said is right. And it's worth saying this is not just my position or the position of a few scientists. This is the position of the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, that explained recently mental health is produced socially. It's a social indicator. It needs social as well as individual solutions. And that can sound a bit strange in the abstract. One of the people who really helped this fall into place for me was a South African psychiatrist I interviewed called Dr. Derek Sommerfeld. Derek happened to be in Cambodia when they first introduced chemical antidepressants there. And the Cambodian doctors didn't know what they were, so they said, what is this? And he explained. And they said, oh, we don't need antidepressants. We've already got them. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community, a rice farmer, who one day had stood on a landmine and had his leg blown off. And they gave him an artificial limb, and he went back to work in the fields. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when you got an artificial limb. I imagine it was pretty traumatic. He started to cry all day, didn't want to get out of bed, classic depression. They said to Derek, we gave him an antidepressant. Derek said, what was it? They said, well, we sat with him. They explained that they listened to his problem. They realized that his pain made sense, right? And they figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. They would get rid of the things that were making him depressed. They bought him a cow. Within a few weeks, his depression went away. They said to Derek, so you see, doctor, that cow was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? And what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the World Health Organization and so many of the scientists I interviewed for Lost Connections have been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not crazy. You're not a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs. Our pain makes sense. There are these nine factors that are driving up depression and anxiety that are not, two of them are biological. Your biology, like your genes, can make you more sensitive to these things, quite a lot more sensitive in some cases. But the main factors that are going on, so to give you some more examples, you know, if you go to work and your work is controlled, so you have very little autonomy or freedom at work, you are significantly more likely to become depressed. If you had a severely traumatic childhood, you are 3,100% more likely to become depressed. There are many factors I go through in the book, and that once you make this perspective shift, that it's not just a problem in your brain. Of course, things go on in your brain, and I describe them in the book. Of course, we are biological creatures. But once you understand that the causes are largely in the way we're living, what that opens up is the possibility of solving those problems in our lives. Now, some of those are things we can do as individuals, and I go through seven things that we can do either as individuals or as a society. We all understand that about, say, car accidents, right? We don't say the job of solving car accidents lies just with people.
Johan, I'm going to cut you off just really quickly because I want to remind everyone that we're talking to Johan Hari right now. He's the author of the book Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel this disconnect or these disconnects that Johan is talking about from people, from meaningful work or the natural world? And do you think it is a factor in your own mental well-being or lack of same? How do you deal with those feelings, and have you found your antidepressant, as Johan was talking about, that thing in your life that you connect to, the people, the activity, the job. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. And Johan, we're going to go to one of our callers right now. We have Heather in Erin. Hi, Heather.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well. What do you have to say?
Well, I just am listening, and it's almost like I'm hearing something that's so directly affecting my life and my two sons. And I think he's spot on as far as the social absence, the social connection that my two sons who are experiencing depression and anxiety and panic attacks. I hate to blame social media and building friendships and bonding behind a smartphone and a screen, but there is that isolation that I see as I'm trying to understand why, to try and help them shake this depression and anxiety.
Heather, thank you so much for that call. So Johan, listening to what Heather had to say about that feeling of being isolated, you know, is really quickly, is there a way to break out of that isolation?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say to Heather is she should be so proud of herself for supporting her sons and loving them through this crisis. I went to the first ever internet rehab center in the United States, it's in Washington, to kind of try to figure out what's going on with the social media obsession that we have. And there's many things I learned there, but one of them that's so fascinating is the woman who runs it, a woman called Dr. Hillary Cash, said to me, a lot of the young men, they get there obsessed with these multiplayer games like World of Warcraft. And she said, what are they getting out of these games? They're getting the things they no longer get from the culture. They're getting a tribe. They're getting a sense of identity. They're getting a sense of status and that they can rise. Again, with social media, you think about the moment when social media arrives, we were already profoundly lonely. And it looks like the thing we've lost, but it doesn't meet our deeper needs, right? The relationship between social media and social life is a bit like the relationship between pornography and sex, right? Pornography will meet a certain basic itch, but it doesn't deeply satisfy us. It's not what we actually need in our lives. And so I think part of the problem is we've become obsessed with these things because they're like the things we've lost, community, tribes, identity, but they're not the things we've lost. They don't meet those deeper needs. And the key is exactly as Heather says, to deeply reconnect with the people around you.
And I want to go to another call. We have Phil in Delafield. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
And what do you have to say, Phil? Phil, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What'd you have to say about the conversation we're having right now?
Well, I have people that I'm concerned about who are dealing with depression. We have a woman friend who had used outdoor physical activity.
So it sounds like what we've heard from Phil is maybe getting outside, reconnecting with the wider natural world can help. A lot of people have written about that being a potential. Have you seen that in the work that you've been doing?
That's so smart. I have a chapter about this in the book, which is, and again, Phil should be really proud of supporting his friend and caring about her. There's all this evidence. Animals in zoos go crazy really often, right? Parrots rip out their feathers. Horses start obsessively swaying. If you deprive an animal of its natural habitat, it will often go crazy. And there's really interesting evidence that I learned from Dr. Isabel Benke, who's one of the leading experts on this, that deprivation from our natural habitat as human beings is driving up our depression and anxiety crisis. In Michigan, there was this really interesting accidental study. The Michigan State Prison, part of it looks out over like lovely green fields, and part of it looks out over concrete. Study found the people who looked out over the concrete were 23% more likely to develop mental health problems than the people who looked out over these green fields, right? It's part of this growing field of evidence that being deprived of exposure to the natural world is terrible for us. So if people can go out into the natural world, that is a really powerful antidepressant. But what we need to do is change our society so more people are free to do that, right? One of my closest relatives is a super hardworking single mom who collapses when she gets home because she's working so hard to pay the rent. To say to her, I'll go for a nice walk in the fields, is kind of cruel, right? Because she can't do that. She's so exhausted, which is why a key part of Lost Connections is about saying we need to change the way our society works, so more people are free to do these things that will make them less depressed. We all know that debate about food, right? Obesity hasn't gone up because people suddenly became greedy. Obesity has gone up because our food system doesn't work properly. It's impossible to walk anywhere. And so what we need to do is change those things rather than just saying to an individual person who's overweight, well, hey, buddy, you need to pull yourself together. There are things individuals can do on obesity and depression, but we need to deal with these deep underlying causes as a society.
And, you know, looking society-wide, is this something that's easier said than done to alleviate some of these issues?
There's so many. In the book, I go through these seven antidepressants that I learned about that are kind of social and psychological antidepressants. One that was very powerful for me is when I was a child, I had experienced some very extreme acts of violence from an adult in my life. And I learned from Dr. Vincent Felitti in San Diego the evidence he discovered, which is really startling evidence, that childhood trauma makes you much more likely to become depressed, obese, addicted as an adult. But what he found that was so powerful is if you give people a space in which they can talk about their trauma, their childhood trauma, and they can see that far from being judged from it, they will be loved more, they'll be congratulated for having survived. That in itself leads to a really significant fall in depression and anxiety. So I go through in Lost Connections seven antidepressants like that, some of which are about solving these deeper problems.
And really quickly, I guess, in the minute that we have left, minute and a half, if there were, I guess, a couple of these, what are some big takeaways that you'd like our listeners to know, maybe to think about moving forward?
Your pain makes sense. If you're depressed and anxious, don't let anyone tell you it's just because there's something wrong inside your skull. There are 9 causes of depression and anxiety, some of which will be playing out in your life, which are not signs of madness. They're not signs that you're irrational. They're signs that something's gone deeply wrong in our culture and our society, so that your needs are not being met. And what you deserve, instead of having your pain pathologized and being told it's some flaw in you, what we need to do is listen to this pain, understand it, see that it makes sense, honor it and respect it, and change our society and the way we live to reduce those drivers of pain in people's lives. It's not because people became weak, and it's not because our brains started suddenly to mysteriously malfunction 30 years ago that we have a depression and anxiety epidemic, an addiction epidemic. It's because something's gone wrong in the way we're living. And that's not just my view, that's the view of the World Health Organization and the UN, who say we need to talk less about chemical imbalances, more about power imbalances.
Johan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, JC. Thanks, Rob. I really enjoyed it. And anyone wants any more information, go to www.thelostconnections.com for more information about the book.
Johan Hari is a writer, journalist, and author, and his new book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions.
And if this is an issue in your life, you can let us know what you've done. Have you found something like what Johan has been talking about, volunteering, getting out in nature, rebuilding those connections that have helped you or someone close to you in your lives? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And let us know your story, and maybe we can share that in a future program here on Central Time. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll continue our series of candidate interviews with the three challengers, three contenders for Wisconsin's Supreme Court race, primary election coming up on February 20th. We've been talking to the candidates all week. You can check out those interviews at wisconsinvote.org and tune in to hear the third and last of those interviews coming up in just a few minutes here on Central Time. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and people are making their dinner reservations and other plans.
And Wisconsin's biggest city may be doing a lot of this celebrating. The Restaurant Review website Open Table ranked the 25 most romantic major cities, and Milwaukee came in at number 11.
Well, now, how would you know a thing like that? Well, here's how the rankings at Open Table worked. They looked at a lot of their own data. They looked at the percentage of restaurants called romantic by the reviewers, okay? The percentage of tables seated for two at restaurants, not sure where they got that info. I guess you can reserve.
Say two.
Two or four or whatever. And the percentage of people who dined out on Valentine's Day last year. So that's how Milwaukee came out number 11 in the country among major cities most romantic.
I'm sure some statisticians might be like, well, yeah, is that really how it works? But I'm also guessing that, I mean, if you're making a reservation around Valentine's Day for two people in Milwaukee, I mean, yeah.
So it's a romantic city. But I, you know, my wife and I try to counter program because what's a great night to not go out to dinner because
exactly.
all the restaurants are crazy crowded. Valentine's Day. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe we're just not very romantic. We steer clear. And, well, here's a confession. That's actually our anniversary.
Oh, look
not,
at you guys.
Not for just, it just worked out that way. It was really
yeah, I'm
not
sure. Wasn't, it wasn't
thing.
Intentional.
We're not romantic like those Milwaukeeans.
Those are. All those Milwaukeeans. Well, now everyone in Milwaukee will be celebrating your anniversary. Just think about it that way.
Yeah, don't do that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.